This is workshop 8 and the last session of the DGHA conference 2014. It's an interactive session with Nadia Metiazzo, Nicole Demera and Tracy Cross speaking on various issues for handlers and dog guides.
This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Can I just say, I'm really not that experienced in terms of dogs. I'm on my second and a half dog, I guess. My first dog had to be retired very early due to a quite an unhappy distraction issue. My second dog, Axel, has some lower back issues, and as he got older, I was noticing he just wasn't so keen to get up in the morning. My workload is quite... I don't think it's intense, but from talking to different trainers, people, and telling them what I do in terms of working, they classify me as intense. So I just do my work, and I'm out in the community. I work in community development, so I have to be out a lot. And I want my third dog, who is a nicely vocal dog. And so I'm not sure that my experience classified as you know, anyway, I guess one of the things that I want to start talking about is the grieving process or the transition from one dog to the next. And for me, this has been a personal thing that I've experienced. My first dog was... I was with him for about 6 months, and in the end, his reaction was something that I could not deal with, and it actually tasted myself and the dog and the thing that he was reacting to in danger. And so I had to make, it was really a seriously snap decision in a public meet, in a public place. He reacted in a way that it is... To me, that was not acceptable, and the decision was made like within that split second. I had to send him back, and he subsequently was retired. But then, as a first handler, you know, can I just go back a little tiny bit? I'm probably in the middle age category, and I considered myself a fairly independent white cane user. Have always used a cane, when I decided that I was actually going to use one, and felt that I didn't need a dog, and what the hell would a dog do for me? You know, I'm quite fine, I don't need one, I'm travelling quite independently, you know, all of those thoughts. As I got older, I kind of maybe became grumpier, I don't know what happens, maybe I loosen things, but I travel a lot through the city, and what I was finding was that using white cane would actually slow me down, because I was actually allowing for the other people, pedestrians, to get past me, because if I didn't slow down, they weren't going to slow down, and I'd end up with a cane that was often shaped like an S, because some people would try and jump it and or break it, and I would always carry a roll of sticky tape with me, a decent tape, because you know, when you fold a cane, snaps, it's kind of like a bit here, a bit there, and a bit somewhere else, and you've got to find it and then put it together. And I, you know, it was probably my fifth cane that really knocked some sense into me, where I was in Flinders Street Station. This guy was waiting for a train, one leg went one way, one leg went the other way, and he probably got a bit of pain. you know what, I did not apologise. No, I actually did, because I always say sorry. It's my first reaction, even when it's not my fault. I didn't really consider it my fault, but I felt really bad. He was in quite a lot of discomfort, and I think I served him right. But I kind of thought, okay, I'm tailoring my speed, my walking speed, my how I get out and about. And in the end, what I was actually doing was going to work earlier and coming home later and making allowances because it was easier to get around. And I thought, why do I need to do this? And, you know, then I decided to get a dog. And I never thought that having a dog would give me so much more independence and get me through those damn crowds so much easier, and people see the dog, they don't see the white cane. So getting back to the story about my first dog, for me, then I had to deal with the process that I was a failure. And that's what I thought. I thought, you know, this dog didn't react in this way before I got it. And that's what I was intimated to me. Mm-hmm. Never seen this reaction before. You know, I don't know how it happened. You yep. know? And so, of course, you go through the whole process of what did I do?
Yep.
And you analyze every minute of every day that you have spent with your dog, usually between the hours of midnight and 5, really, and you blame yourself. And the first thing that I can say from personal experience with A, having to retire that dog really early, and B, having to retire my second dog because of health issues, mm-hmm. who was an excellent working dog, had a mouth on him like you wouldn't believe, but was awesome. And maybe there's a hint there that the dogs probably didn't have a mouth on them before they came to me. and that whole process, it really isn't anybody's fault. And sometimes those things happen once. You know, most of the dogs are working with instructors who have vision, and that's where I come from. And the people, although the instructors are awesome in their work, and they often do undergo blindfold work with the dogs, it's not ever quite the same. And I've talked to instructors, and they will agree, you know, the ones that I've spoken to with me, that it is never quite the same, and you can never tell how that dog will be once it's out there with a person who has no vision or very little vision and does not react in the same way that the trainer who has built up a strong bond with that dog has, you know, reacts. If, say, for instance, your dog has dog distraction, the person with vision will see that there may be a possibility of your dog being distracted because he will or she will see the dog in the distance. For us, as handlers, my dog will react very similarly in different situations. Sometimes it could be a dog here. He's a golden retriever. I keep telling him he's a black Labrador, but he's a golden retriever because he will bird watch. And he will stalk a bird. I'll be walking along the street and I'll think, oh my God, you're in stalk mode, you're prancing. That's what he does when he's distracted. Okay, so I have to figure out, is it a dog? Is it a bird? Is it a flag? And the way you react is really important, because if it is something like a bird, then the way you follow through with your instruction to the dog is going to be maybe a bit different to if it's another dog and you don't want your dog to lunge at the other dog. So that's the biggest challenge I find in understanding and forming my relationships with my dogs. And I think for guide dog and dog guide instructors, and I don't know how we do this, whether we start, you know, people who are blind should become instructors, I don't know. But there needs to be a way of reinforcing this to, you know, and for more prolonged time, I guess. And again, I only can speak on my interactions with Seeing Eye Dogs Australia and the amount of blindfold work they may do with their dogs. I don't know about other organisations. But really, it is really important for that to happen. And then you, I guess in terms of the reactions that they might have when they do come to you, could be a little bit different. And in terms of the grieving process, I think part of what organisations should do to assist clients when they are you know, going through that process is to offer them some form of, whether it be peer support through the different groups that are established, or whether it be actual counselling where you can actually talk it out and get over that. Because for me, I know that when I got my second dog, I was reacting because of the reactions that my first dog had, and you just can't help it, it just happens. But now on my third, I'm thinking, well, okay, there are things that I'm taking with, you know, to all three of my dogs, and there are the reactions that I'm having that are caused by, you know, issues that I've had or may not have had with my other dogs. you've got to learn to kind of separate yourself from that, and I guess consider every job as a new tool. I don't like saying that, but you know, that's the reality and stuff. So I just think talking it out, even if you talk it out with other dog users, dog handlers, you know, it may not always be the best way because their experiences could be different, but even just talking it out, I think is a really good thing. I don't know if Nicole, I know that she's going through a bit of a process at the moment with her dogs, whether she can add to it. Oh, yeah, okay. Thank you.
If I could just make a quick comment about the grieving process as a former grief counsellor. It's really important that you allow yourself to grieve and really grieve. And because if you don't grieve the first time around, it's going to keep creeping up on you. And so that every time you have to have a new dog or there's another grief in your life, it's going to catch up with you and you're going to have to do a lot more work on it.
I'm going to move over to Nicole now, who had her hand up anyway, but she was on the panel anyway. But here you go, Nicole.
Okay, so I guess my comments not only address the other handlers in this room, but also to the trainers. I think we saw a couple of trainers here, which is great. A couple of things. Firstly, I'd really like to say to you, to the trainers, that it's so important that, and I wish I could say this to the school hierarchy, it's true, because literally, your trainers at the coalface, your trainers that have to work with us, the clients, they can really cop it when you've got a client who's coming in who's grieving. I mean, for me, with my training with this second dog, I got a pretty good case of what I like to call SDL, successor dog syndrome. I have issues with second dog syndrome because, to be fair, this is not something that just hits you with your second dog. It might hit you with your second dog, it might hit you with your third dog. Even if it does hit you with your second, that no way protects you from it hitting you again. So for me, I came in and, you know, the trainers are, they're kind of assuming that, oh, you're happy to be here, isn't this great, we're giving you a new dog. And the client next to me, the room next to me, oh sure, it was their first dog, and they were thrilled to bits, they couldn't wait. Me, I'll tell you about sleep, I'll tell you about being devastated, being heartbroken, being shattered. This dog was the dog I needed, not the dog I wanted. I was heartbroken over the first one. He retired early for health reasons. And I was sitting in the room just trying not to burst into tears by the time that they handed me the dog's lead. I pretty much wanted to just hand the lead back so he can have him back now. Like, I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. You know, I had headaches. Like, these are the physical manifestations of grief. The trainer's going, you're not eating very much. It's like, yeah, you're right. I was dropping weight. I mean, a client in that mindset isn't really in the best possible frame of mind to start training. But I really sucked it up and I kept trying. But like, I remember at the last day of an intensive week, because I did 1 week in a motel and then I came home for 2 weeks and it was the final morning, Friday morning. And we're doing this walk and the trainer comes up to me and says, you need to do A, or whatever it was. I can't even remember. I'm like, okay. I didn't do it. The trainer kept and came back and said, look, you need to be doing A. Okay, I didn't do it. And this kept happening, the trainer was getting a bit frustrated with me because I couldn't understand why the message was not getting through. It's like I couldn't connect the dots. On the one hand, I agreed with the trainer, I understood what he was saying, but I couldn't make it happen. And it was only later, the trainer didn't realize it, but I was struggling to not burst into tears because, you see, after this walk, I had to take the new dog home. And my old dog wasn't there. And I didn't want to take the new one home. And I was so gutted that I was going to have to take this new dog home that I wasn't attending to the walk on the day. I wasn't paying attention to the trainer in the present because I was already thinking about the future that I didn't want, that was taking this new dog home. And so I was trying really hard to not just burst into tears in the middle of public and make a big scene because I was just trying to grit my teeth and get through the walk. And it was only later I was able to say to the trainer, look, I realise you're not psychic. You couldn't have understood that this is what was going on for me. And so after that, we came up with a word, a key phrase that I could just say to the trainer at any time, and the trainer knew, okay, client not coping. Don't know what's triggered the client, don't know why she's upset, but let's drop the handle, let's go for a walk, let's sit down, let's have a coffee, let's deep breathe, let's do something else. Not going to get very far with training right now. And that worked better. So I actually did talk to my school's counselling department, and I was such a big help to them that they ended up rewriting their grief modules, which was kind of funny, because I went to them for help, but I ended up helping them, that's fine. And they even sent all their trainers on a half-day class of, this is how to deal with difficult people. And the trainer came back to me and goes, yeah, we did this class. And I was like, oh, that's really good. I'm so pleased. And they go, no, I wasn't talking about you. I said, no, but I was. See, I can say, yeah, was I difficult? Was I a challenge? Absolutely. Unfortunately for me, for various reasons I'm not going to go into, I'm walking down this journey again after only another 13 months. And so, yeah, I'll be back on class again soon, Joy, and I'll try and not be quite as challenging and quiet this time around. But when you're off the back of two really premature retirements, neither of which are my fault, but yeah, you still feel really bad, and you still feel like it's somehow your fault. And even though people say to you, oh, but the next one will be better, just like this is a good thing, you're getting on top. And I'm thinking, yeah, but I'm still the one who's gutted. I'm still the one who put in a year's hard work into this last dog, and it's all gone up in smoke. And I just decided again, and no, I'm not happy about that. And I know it's the right decision to make to have to retire this dog, and I don't disagree with it, but no, I'm sorry, I'm not jumping for joy. So even though my school would go, yeah, we've got another great dog, this is going to be awesome this time, I'm kind of I'm going, yeah, sure, like really? And so please, even to those of you who, I think there is at least one person who's in senior management at a school, please support your staff to support us, the clients. Please understand that these people, I mean, the cadet trainer that spoke to us before, she's got a background in zoology or something, but animal, whatever, which is awesome. But the thing is, that's not a psychology degree. And I'm sorry, but when you're matching clients with dogs, you're dealing with the human mind. So it's not so much about the dog anymore, it's about helping your clients with their process. So yeah, I'll be the last one to say.
Penny has a question, and then I'll go to Tracy. I'm working my way to Penny. Mine's not so much of a question, but just an agreement with everything that everyone's said. I've had a similar situation to Nadia, and yeah, you know, I'm 5 years into this next dog, and I'm still grieving, I'm still upset, and you know, it's really challenging. And the other thing that I'm finding is that in both my last dogs, you know, there were things that I noticed in training that I mentioned, and they just didn't seem to be believed on you know, when I first said it, and it's continued to be an issue. And it was like, you know, I didn't feel that it was ever written down anywhere, so that then, you know, when I go back and say, well, actually, I did notice this on day one. You know, there was no record ever kept that I'd noticed that on day one. And then, you know, like with my second dog that had the health issues, you know, like I noticed some of those behaviours right from class, and I brought them up, and I was told, oh, she's just, what's that thing when they're going over from the trainer to the handler? You know, it's just that little part, you know. Yeah, it's another word, but yeah, you know, so like I found for me that, you know, sometimes my views weren't validated. You know, it's just put down to, oh, you're in class and you don't actually know, and it'll pass, and you know.
Yeah, you don't know this dog.
Yeah, you don't know, this exactly right. You know, I've noticed that she was stopping short of the curb, and my instructor would say, oh, she's just getting in a better position to see up the street. And it's like, I don't really care what she's doing. She's not getting me to the curb, you know. Like, and so it was sort of, you know, flippantly dealt with. And the other thing that was the guilt that I think Nadia, you know, sort of touched on about,
yeah.
You know, my dog had serious health issues, and, you know, the fact that I wasn't prepared to A, fork out however much money for the treatment, or B, not prepared to work with a dog on raw food diet, or, you know, like all of that stuff. So, you know, I just wanted to say thank you very much for saying exactly what I was feeling.
Going over to Tracy now.
Just still on the retirement issue, I've been lucky enough to have worked to guide dogs into retirement due to old age. Holly is my third dog. But what I would say to those of you is with my first guide dog when she retired, I had, when I initially had her, I was living at home. And my mum said to me one day, when she retires, can I have her? And I said, so I didn't really think about it. And I said, yeah, sure. So when it came time for her to retire, I had said to my mum she could have her, and she asked for her. And I said, you know, of course I said I would, so I gave it to her. And I would recommend if any of you are at all able to keep your dog after it's retired to do so. The guilt that I felt at giving her up after all that she had done for me was, and the grief I felt through that was actually worse than, you know, with my second dog I kept her until, you know, she passed away, and it was actually worse than that grief. So. Yeah, if I could just, that would be my tip for anyone else. Also, with my graduating from my second to my third dog, my guide dog trainer with my second dog, she always told me that I had the Rolls Royce model of guide dog with my second dog, Rosie, and it's taken me probably 4 years of training with Holly to accept her, that she, you know, accept her as a dog that's different, and not to think of her as not being as good a dog as my second dog. So it's taken me that long to bond with her. So I would say, you know, if you are in that situation, so please let that go as early on as you can, because it's, you know, unfortunately it's, taken quite a while to really accept Holly for who she is, and you know, that's a shame for the dog. Yeah.
I'll open it up now for just general questions. Anything. It's a free-for-all now, so I'm going to start with Penny Rogers.
I want someone to tell me all about travelling overseas or long distances.
Yep, I'm coming over to Pam, who will answer that question.
Thank you. Pam Hay from Melbourne. My first guide dog travelled to Europe 3 times. The guide dog I have at the moment, Willoughby, he's been to Europe 2 times. He's been on a cruise, and he's off to America next year. I wondered... when you're travelling overseas, you must check that the airline is one that you are allowed to take a dog in the cabin. Going to England or Europe, it was Singapore Airlines, Qantas or British Airways, but of course now Qantas has teamed up with
Emirates,
so you can only get so far if you're from a different plane. So I've always travelled Singapore Airlines, and they've been fantastic. There is a lot of procedures to go through with quarantine. Before you leave the country, you have to contact the country that you're going to. Once you're in Europe, there's no problems at all. Once you're in England, you can travel anywhere between the countries in the common market. You do have to do the flea and worming each time you go back into England, so you don't want to be chopping across the channel too often, otherwise your dog gets, you know, defleed and dewormed every time. When you're coming back to Australia, you do have to follow a procedure of a blood test a fortnight before you come back to Australia. Then once that blood test results come through, they get faxed to Australia, and then the day before you leave, you have to get the dog wormed and defleed again. Then when you come home, the quarantine rules are in-house quarantine, and what that entails is for 10 days your dog is not allowed to socialise with any other cats or dogs. You are allowed to work the dog, but only on main roads and main footpaths, and he's not allowed to go to any parks or farms. So really it is a very small price to pay to have your dog with you overseas. If you are going less than 4 weeks, I would not take the dog.
Yep.
I don't think it would be worth it.
Yeah.
Anything over that, yes, but it does cost you. My last trip when I went to Europe with my dog, I kept a really close tally on the costs, and it worked out to be $1,480 to have had the dog go with me. That's because of the rabies vaccinations, the blood tests, all the vet visits that you have to do crossing to and from Europe, etc. It's up to you whether you think you can afford to do that and whether that cost is worth it. Going to America, it's going to be a little bit different, and it's going to be a little bit harder because America has different diseases, and the dog has to be seen by a vet 4 weeks before you leave, so there's no point in you going, taking a dog if you are and going for 4 weeks, because you've got to start the procedure to go home the day you arrive. And also on a cruise, if you cruise around the Pacific, the dog, we gave him a little bit of a challenge there as well, because the cruise that we went on was only 9 days. And fortnight before you come back into the country, the dog's got to have the test. So the test before we leave. So they sort of re-looked at all that paperwork and whatever. And it turned out what we had to do is sign a paper that the dogs would not go ashore. Now, there was two dogs on board the ship, on with a group of friends, and the quarantine people were great. We still had to fill out the export papers and still had to fill out the import papers. But you know, the dog didn't actually leave Australia, to be quite honest, because they never, ever got off the ship. But again, it was still worth it. My dog never took me to the wrong cabin. I went to the right cabin every time. We had fabulous attention on board, so I could always very much recommend a cruise to anyone with their guide dog. The benefits of taking the dog with me, as good as a husband or a partner can be, I still don't think they're as good a guide as a dog. My husband's name is Doug, and I say the only difference between Doug and the dog is the letter U. But the dog, I had my independence when I was away. I didn't have to rely on him because I was in a totally unknown area. I didn't have any mobility aids at that time, no GPSs or anything. We would go out for a walk and around the local area where the hotel was, and I taught my dog that wherever their map was, that was home. So I'd go out, and if I had enough, I'd just say to Doug, I'm going back to the hotel, and I'd tell the dog, find home, and we would get back to the hotel. I do recommend taking a dog, but not unless it's more than 4 weeks. Any questions?
Yeah, coming around.
Then they got up first.
And then Anna, and then Vanessa.
I just wanted to ask a question about cruising, because I didn't take my dog. I knew she could go on the ship, but were you allowed to leave her on board and go ashore yourself, or did you have to have someone stay with her?
The staff did offer to have the dog in the office with them, the steward, what do you call him, the purser. Yeah, they offered to have the dogs in the office. Unfortunately, Willoughby suffers terribly from separation anxiety. He was okay if I left him on the board as long as he was with the other dog. And one of our group. If it had been my first dog, I would have been quite happy to leave him, but I wouldn't leave Willoughby. But what we did, we took it in turns of going ashore. So one of us would do a half day tour in the morning, and the other one would do a half day tour in the afternoon. So we always had the dog. And I must tell you about something that happened in the lift. I was looking after the dogs, the two of them. And I thought, I'm not going to sit in the cabin, I'm going up on deck with my talking book and my knitting. So I get in the lift, and this woman in there says, oh, you've got two dogs. And I said, yes, I've got double vision. But she didn't laugh, and I thought, oh, really? So I got out of the next floor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have one little
comment
about the
cruise.
Yeah. Because the toileting procedure.
Oh, toileting procedure. Oh, well, we were very concerned about that before we left, but the ship was notified, of course, that they were going to have guide dogs on board, and they fell over backwards to make sure everything was right for us. They even got life belts for the dogs, life jackets, yes. And realising that we wouldn't be able to fit their harnesses on over the top of these life jackets, they actually had sewn onto them a handle that we could use. They were just fantastic. This was Neano we went with. They also wanted to know what food they could cook for the dog, etc. And we said, well, no, we just got our dry dog food. Thank you, we'll feed their dogs. But I wouldn't mind two carrots at lunchtime, meaning one for each dog. But no, at lunchtime every day, wherever we were on the ship, they found us with this silver platter. And we got four carrots, so we had this pile of carrots but the toileting, they set up a big sandbox down the back of the boat, back of the ship, and the dogs were supposed to toilet on that. Well, we were using the toileting harnesses at that stage, and neither of the dogs used that sandbox once. They'd stand beside it and do it, but they would not go in the sandbox. So if you are taking a dog on a cruise, I do suggest that you try to train them to go on a sandbox, because that is what they used. But every morning they came and they raked that and they took away into the little basket that they had there with the droppings in it.
So my question's been answered.
I can't top that lot. I haven't taken my dogs on the long haul trips, but I have taken her all around New Zealand, and I found it was really, because I travel on my own, it was absolutely fantastic, because they love a challenge, and when you don't know where you're going, to be able to tell the dog, okay, let's go and see where we go, sort of thing. And it was the first time they'd ever had a guide dog on board a yacht, and on board a jet boat, and on board a baby little plane up into the back country. And she was exemplary, and it was great. But what I was actually going to say was, it's actually still very expensive, even when it's New Zealand. And their protocols are very, very strict. They actually say they're probably around the strictest in the world. And not a cheap process, as Pam says, and lots of paperwork. And the most difficult part was coming back into Australia when they said, oh, we haven't been notified. Oh, yes, we have. Anyway, another story, but always check. But I did. And the vet said, yes, it's all gone through. But if you had finding a vet, because I was out in the back country, and getting the right vet at the right time was a bit tricky. So there's all those sorts of considerations as well.
Also on the DGHA website is an audio presentation from Cheng Hock, who we mentioned yesterday, about how he travels around between Perth and Singapore and other Asian countries with his dog guide. It's worth listening to. And while I've got the microphone, I can say that Steve Clifford from Cellar Door Tours does trips to the Barossa and McLaren Vale and all that around the various winery areas of Adelaide, if you're staying on. Very guide dog friendly. His daughter is studying animal science at university, and they couldn't do enough for me and Greg on Thursday when we did a full day tour of the Barossa. Any other questions? Yes, Penny.
What about the actual flight? Because I was talking to, I think it was Anna or someone last night, and you know, like the flight to the States is 16 hours or something from Melbourne. And, you know, like what do you do with the dogs in such a long flight and food and stuff like that?
I've known people's dogs to go up to 18 hours without leaving, so it really is dependent on the dog's ability. But if anyone else wants to comment. Where was that? Yes, Pam. Pam's our expert.
Yeah.
Before I leave to go, about a month before I leave on a long haul trip, I start making my dog hang on for a minimum of 12 hours overnight. So I toilet him about 8 o'clock in the evening and don't toilet again until 8 a.m. I also start using a piddle pad, you know, the puppy pads. So first thing in the morning, take him outside, quick, and I stick the piddle pad under him as soon as he starts. And I do that for a few days. Then I put the pad on the grass and tell him, quick, and
he's got the idea that I'm wanting him to stand over that peel pad. But then you've got to teach them to do it inside, because they're going to be doing it inside a plane. So pick an area of the house or your property where the dog doesn't normally go. Well, I chose the garage because he never went in the garage. It's just a disaster in there. So I chose the garage and I put the peel pad down in there and was telling him quick. So he just sat on it and looked at me as if I was stupid. And that was for about 3 or 4 days. He did that, and then one day I thought, well, I'm going to make him do it, and we won't leave the garage until he's done it. And he did it, and from then on, now, if he sees a people pad down in the garage, he will do a pill on it. So on the plane, you speak to the air hostesses or the cabin crew, and say you'd like to give your dog the opportunity to toilet, and what they do is they pull the curtains across at the back of the aeroplane, and you can put the peel pads down there and give the dog the opportunity to peel. Now, going to Europe, I choose a midnight flight from Melbourne to Singapore, and so it's about an 8-9 hour flight or whatever it is, and that's fine, they've got a problem, go up onto the roof garden, toilet the dog. Now, drinking, I haven't given the dog a drink on that flight at all. So once we arrive there, we give him a drink, toilet him, then walk around a little bit, give him a little bit of food, about half a normal feed, and make sure that he does drop-ins before we get on the plane, and another drink before we leave. On the plane, I'd only give him little sips all the way. Now, I've also got a Kong, which is the old spaceship one, and I can put food in it, push it in, and it takes him about an hour and a half to get those 3 pieces of pellets out of it. Well, he's happy, being entertained with that. So I don't actually feed him on the plane and only give him little sips of water. Neither of my dogs have people actually on the pill pad in the plane, but I know that they would do it if they were desperate. The other dog, he held on for 17 hours, and I really thought he was going to flood London when he took the I normally count when my dog is piddling, because it's one way that you can tell if there is anything wrong with their kidneys. And normally, during the day, it's between 12 and 15. First thing in the morning, it's 15 to 20. Yeah, I've got up to over 200. So, full of bladder, yes. So that's how I dealt with the toileting and the feeding on the plane.
Because the airlines use the absorbent mats on domestic flights, does that confuse your dog?
No, I always put my own mat on top of their mat. But also, their mats aren't absorbent. They're just those ones that they use in the hospital, very, very thin. Whereas the pedal pads are more like you can get the ones that are more like a baby's nappy, much, much thicker, and they absorb a lot more water.
Any other
random
questions? No?
No, okay.
Huh? Okay, if you had one thing to say to a dog guide handler, what would it be? Okay.
Well, I suppose I'm going to reiterate what I said yesterday. It's a team effort. I've heard a lot of discussion about what's wrong with your guide dog skills, but really, have you told them? And communication is the key to a healthy environment with anything you do.
Anyone else have anything to say?
I'll just...
Hang on, I've got Paul.
Yep.
And then Greg.
I'm just going to wind it up.
I just wanted to say it's been a real pleasure for me to be here, and a fabulous opportunity for me to talk about dogs, but listen to you about the things that concern you and what you perceive your needs to be. And they're the sorts of things that I can take back to my school to make sure we're providing the services and meeting your needs in the way that you want them met. So thank you all for sharing some of your comments and for the opportunity for me to listen to those.
And under an NDIS where people have choice and control, why not make your dog guide school or organisation the place to be, the best place to get a dog guide from?
I move to Greg.
That's the end of the end.
All right, we're just coming up with 5 minutes to go. We've done fantastically. We've caught up on today's. Just to wrap things up, the reason for, well, we won't call it a debacle because it actually worked out quite well, the photographic interlude out on the deck is what we're going to do. We've had a bit of a quick meeting with some of the executive people, and we wanted to give the Grand Chifley something to remember us by. So we are going to get a photo framed and send it to them so they can hang it up in there. Well, wherever they like. Just as a reminder of
a restaurant.
Or a restaurant or something like that.
Oh, maybe we should decide.
Yeah, once again, I'd like to thank a lot of people. Thanks very much to Erica for doing a lot of running around. There's many people, each and every one of you in this room that helped each other when help was needed or advice was sought. Thanks the dogs. So the dogs have got treats to go home with.
They all played nicely.
Yeah, they did. The committee's now going to go off, not today, but certainly in the next couple of weeks. We're going to talk about what worked here, what didn't work. If you've got any advice in and around that, use the lists that we've got to give us some suggestions about any gaps that you thought that there were. With the weekend, there was some consideration about if we did have another conference, we will have another conference, but when that might be, we might have it biannually. And we thought that, well, why not have them here? Because people know this place. You can't fault it for access to toileting areas. It's a great design there. It's a reasonably quiet area. There's a range of accommodation for people who want to, spend as least or as much as they want to. And the staff here have been absolutely fantastic. So that's something that we can And for those who didn't get a chance, just explore the local area within the block of the hotel here. There's probably about at least half a dozen fantastic restaurants at all sorts of different price ranges. So if you decide to come back next time and come a day earlier or a day later. For those staying on, I hope you enjoy Adelaide. If you get a chance to do one of these tours of the Barossa or Clare Valley or whatever, take that on board. Once again, thank you to Guide Dogs Australia, Seeing Guide Dogs Australia, Royal Society for the Blind, Blueprint Media, BM Snacks, Natural Fours. I think you'll agree, I thought it's gone really well. I mean, I've never been to a conference where people seem to be so interested in the topics. Usually there's a bit of a lag of people snore here or there. Even the dog, I didn't hear too many dogs snoring in a dead giveaway. So there was, I think people seem to enjoy themselves. Thank you very much to the committee that are here and those that aren't. And congratulations once again to Rowena Dowling, your inaugural a Golden Harness Award winner for DGHA, and please enjoy your flights home and be safe.
And thank you to Greg.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?